Welcome back. Our next case, United States v. Ruiz. Lieutenant Bilter, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the appellant?
Yes, sir.
Lieutenant Commander Wuju, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government?
Yes, sir.
Very well, then. Please proceed.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, honorable judges of the court, and may it please the court. My name is Lieutenant Raymond Bilter, and I, along with Major Colin Hotard, represent the appellant in this case, Corporal Dominic Ruiz, United States Marine Corps. Chief Judge Olson, I respectfully request 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
Thank you, Your Honor. When he tried to kiss me, I said, no, stop, and I pushed his face away. That was the testimony on direct, but that wasn't the charged conduct. The government's admission of a prior statement was unfair because not only was it inconsistent with that statement on direct, but it cured an issue of the government's own making. Therefore, this court should set aside the finding and sentence and reverse the lower court. First, this prior statement was not actually consistent with that statement on direct. When it says, he tried to kiss me, I said, no, stop, and I pushed his face away. What she's saying is that she's saying no to kissing. She's not saying no to the charged conduct. By contrast, she told that she said no when appellant, at best, this testimony is ambiguous. At worst, this testimony on direct is just her testifying that she wasn't consenting to kissing. And so to the extent that this testimony on direct was ambiguous, this goes directly to the prejudice in this case because it filled that material gap in the government's case as to what its case dispositive witness was saying no to. It cleared up that ambiguity, and clearing up ambiguities isn't the purpose of MRE 801D1B2. The government needed that statement in order to prove the element of non-consent in light of her testimony that she's saying no to kissing and pushing his face away. But not only that, in terms of the additional prejudice in this case, the quality of that evidence was coming through a law enforcement officer, not coming through his own testimony. In front of members, a law enforcement officer is going to have a certain amount of credibility. And then the members were specifically instructed to consider the prior statement for its truth, which then brought that statement to the attention of the members during the instructions phase. And then getting to the government's closing argument, the trial counsel punctuated, quote, she says no, she says no, she did this, she says no. They're punctuating it throughout the very end of their closing argument. This bolsters the testimony of the government's case dispositive witness, which is exactly what this rule is designed to do. However, it was inadmissible under this rule, and so now we have impermissible bolstering. And then finally on rebuttal, the trial counsel emphasized to the members, quote, she told what happened, end quote. This at the end helps to patch up the reasonable doubt that her testimony had created. Second, this statement was not relevant to rehabilitate this witness. First, there was no attack in the sense of that word as used in this rule. There wasn't an attack on this witness because the government put alcohol blackouts in issue first. They did it in their opening, and then they did it again multiple times during direct. And so the defense, by the time cross-examination occurred, the defense is just rolling with the information that the government had already themselves elicited, and then their questions were aimed at setting up their closing argument.
So why does that matter, though? If the defense went down that path, it was still a choice they made. Why didn't the defense, by doing so, open the door? It's not your position that if the government had solely done that and the defense didn't walk through that door itself, that would have permitted the introduction of the prior consistent statement?
Well, Your Honor, because the government shouldn't be allowed to rehabilitate an issue that they introduced. So
just because the government first raised it, it doesn't matter that the defense also raised that point?
Under the facts and circumstances of this case, Your Honor, No, it doesn't matter that the defense then continued that line of questioning during cross-examination, because it was if it was it's not an attack because the government started with that information, and so the word attack, as contemplated in this rule, should be read to be an attack that the defense is lodging. And irrespective of what the
government
is doing.
Where do you find support for that position?
Your Honor, just from the plain language of the rule itself, because the rule is saying that there has to be an attack in order for there to be a prior consistent statement. And it's not an attack when the defense is simply reiterating points about alcohol blackouts and gaps in this witness's memory that the government themselves first started doing.
So wasn't the attack, though, on the ability of the witness to recall what had occurred?
Your Honor, if this court...
Doesn't that constitute an attack?
Well, Your Honor, if this court does find that it is an attack within the meaning of that rule, the attack was specifically about unreliable memory due to alcohol-induced blackouts. And this is where the military judge erred in her ruling, because the government's assertion that the attack was about faulty memory was erroneous, and the judge erroneously applied that assertion, because there's a difference between faulty memory and specifically unreliable memory due to an alcohol-induced blackout.
And you make that point in your brief, but what practical effect should that have in terms of the application of this rule? I understand the distinction you're making that it was incapable of registering memory as compared to not challenging his memory itself. But what practical effect does that have in terms of the application of the rule here?
Because as this court held in United States v. Finch, the prior statement has to actually be relevant to rehabilitate the witness's credibility on the basis on which she attacked. The prior statement in this case didn't do that. And it's specifically because of the timing of when this statement was made. Because the statement was made to hours after this incident at the hospital, and the point here is that she has already come out of a blackout, and at that point her memory is already tainted. The expert testimony that the defense elicited in its case illustrates that. So the purpose of the attack was that her memory was already not functioning correctly at the time that she spoke to, and that same malady persisted all the way through trial. There was no difference in the onset of that malady, to borrow a term from the Kentucky Supreme Court, between the time that the prior statement was made and when she took the stand at trial. And so if her memory was already unreliable then, it's still unreliable now, and so that prior statement doesn't rehabilitate that witness on that ground.
Was that explained before the trial court? Isn't the rule that it's dependent upon what the jury or panel would have inferred from the questioning?
Yes, Your Honor, but the fair inference here is that this is about alcohol-induced blackouts. The defense's questions on cross were directly aimed at that throughout the cross-examination. They asked her specifically, you never blacked out before, is that correct? You're having gaps in your memory about that night, isn't that correct? But not only that, this is also illustrated in the defense's closing argument, Joint Appendix 435, where the defense counsel says, so the question again is how reliable are his memories? Not reliable at all. He says things like, this is a false memory. He asserts she absolutely forms consent and doesn't recall it, and emotions are a contributor in how you fill that gap. This was the entire defense's case theory, was about the unreliability about alcohol-induced blackouts. This wasn't a case that we typically see, Your Honor, where perhaps the cross-examination is aimed at some sort of untruthfulness or motive to fabricate, or even a situation where it's the defense asserting that a blackout occurred and the complaining witness saying, no, I didn't have any blackouts, and so we're having a battle in that regard. None of that happened in this case. This was forthright about the fact from the very beginning that she was suffering from fragmentary blackouts. And so because that was the basis of the attack, that's the fair inference from the entire defense's case theory, is that, because that's the ground for the attack, this prior statement to death did not rehabilitate that. The case that we cited from the Kentucky Supreme Court, Busey v. Commonwealth, well, it's certainly not binding on this court in any way, but it's an eloquent example of how this is not rehabilitative, because in that case, the complaining witness was a mentally handicapped person. And as the Kentucky Supreme Court said, the onset of that malady didn't change from the time that that witness spoke to law enforcement to the time of trial. And so the Kentucky Supreme Court ruled that this prior statement made to law enforcement wasn't relevant to rehabilitate that witness because the malady hadn't changed. And that's exactly the case that we have here. Similarly, in United States v. Cox, which is the Sixth Circuit that we cited in our brief, demonstrates the same thing about the importance of the timing of the prior statement, where in Cox, the allegation from the defense was that the complaining witness was only remembering things after being shown pictures by law enforcement, and there the Sixth Circuit held that the prosecution was allowed to bring in a prior statement that predated the showing of those pictures because the timing of that prior statement actually did rehabilitate the complaining witness because the timing of that statement was before the pictures were actually shown to that child witness. And so all of this is consistent with what the common law calls the temporal priority doctrine, which, as we argued in our brief, this court should take the opportunity to apply the temporal priority doctrine and find that that common law doctrine carries over into the codification of this rule, specifically because both the advisory committee notes for the federal rule of evidence when this amendment was adopted, as well as the analysis in the 2016 Manafort courts martial, have the exact same advisory language, which is specifically the amendment does not make any consistent statement admissible that was not admissible previously. The only difference is that the prior consistent statements otherwise admissible for rehabilitation are now admissible substantively as well. And therefore, the common law doctrine of temporal priority should still be applicable to 801D1B2 as it is in 801D1B1, specifically when the attack is about a want for capacity to remember or observe. So it's not necessarily in every case, in every type of attack, but when the grounds for the attack upon the witness are about memory or about the ability to observe things, this common law doctrine should apply. And it should have been applied in this case. And that's also another reason why the military judge abused her discretion.
Counsel, wasn't part of the Civilian Defense Counsel's line of questioning about the victim's story changing, right? You're mentioning things now that you didn't mention before. You mentioned things before that you're not mentioning now, and that the story may be evolved or changed over time. Is that not an attack on her credibility, and to say, like, you don't really know what happened because your story keeps changing, and then the military judge says, we can go back to this more contemporaneous statement and see what she said then. Like, why isn't that a logical thing for the military judge to do to rebut this attack on the changing testimony of the changing statements of the victim over time? It's not just a I don't remember problem that you're describing with that theory, but it's really more of a changing statements over time, inconsistent statements over time problem.
Yes, Your Honor, it's those questions certainly were an attack on the witness's credibility. However, it wasn't an attack based on, the type of credibility matters here. The credibility issue wasn't about truthfulness. The questions were not aimed at trying to suss out, fabrication or untruthfulness. Those questions about you're saying things now that you didn't say then, they all still related to the same attack, which is an unreliable memory due to alcohol-induced blackouts. They're highlighting for the members that she's saying things now that she didn't say then to show the unreliability of her memory, not to show things like on truthfulness or some other ground. And so the ground of this attack has been consistent throughout that cross-examination and the defense's case. And so that's why the asking of those inconsistency questions doesn't change the legal analysis and doesn't change the outcome here. For all of these reasons, this court should set aside the finding and sentence, and if there are no further questions from the court, I respectfully request to reserve the balance of my time.
Certainly.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Lieutenant Bilter. Lieutenant Commander Wu Zhu.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, and may it please the court. I'm Lieutenant Commander James Wuzu, and with Colonel Ian Pedden, I represent the United States. In this case, testifies to three narrow statements: that the victim told him she said no, that she was crying, and that she did not recall going up the stairs. This was generally consistent with her testimony, and the trial defense counsel had attacked her on what she remembered telling law enforcement. Accordingly, this court should affirm for two reasons. First, the military judge did not abuse her discretion in admitting the victim's prior consistent statement. And second, the appellant suffered no prejudice. Turning to the third Finch factor in particular, the statement need be generally consistent, but it need not be identical in every detail, and that's what this court held in Foster. This comports with what the federal courts say as well, which acknowledge that statements will diverge to a certain degree and need not be identical in every detail. That is precisely what we have here. There was no extra statement that was misleading. There was nothing that was added to the victim's statement that was elicited from death, and that is what is required under the rules. If the appellant thought that it was something that was relevant to introduce additional context for that statement, that's something that they could have done on cross-examination. That's not something that was done here. That's something that's being raised before this court for the first time.
Counsel, what about appellant's argument that her statement was ambiguous? Was she saying just no to the kissing or saying no to the entire conduct, including the charged conduct, and that the government has to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, and there's this ambiguity, and by bringing in this statement, which is not wholly consistent, the government was able to not just rehabilitate, but actually bring in substantive evidence on the specific issue, one of the specific issues for the charged conduct. In other words, it's not just that we bring in some evidence that's not entirely consistent, because I don't think that's appellant's position, that it has to be 100% consistent. It's that you can't clarify an essential ambiguity by bringing in a prior consistent statement.
Your Honor, respectfully, the rule does not specifically point to it being a central issue. With regard to this court's opinion in Finch, the prior statement must be consistent, but that part does not have to go to a central question or not go to a central question. What that part of the analysis is consists of the inconsistent parts of the statement, which those cannot go to a central question. So in Finch, that concerned the sleeping bag, the orientation of the various persons involved, and that was something that the court found was an inconsistent statement, but did not violate the rules because it did not go to a central issue. Instead, the rule does not require what Your Honor is suggesting.
So let me ask you a broad-based question then. So in your brief, you argue that if there are inconsistencies, omissions, lack of credibility, faulty memory, then that opens the door for prior consistent statements. I think it's fair to say that the vast majority of cross-examinations are going to cover those four things.
Yes, sir.
So what does the government view as being the limiting principles that should be applied here so that the approach that you're articulating doesn't blow open the doors for prior consistent statements to come in virtually any time a witness is cross-examined?
Yes, Your Honor, and there's two aspects of this. The first is protected by this Court's opinion in Finch itself, which lays out the factors which do limit, and in this case do limit, what can be admitted. It has to ultimately be relevant to the basis upon which she was attacked. So here, the trial defense counsel specifically asked, do you recall saying certain things to law enforcement? And she either says no or I do not remember in a series of questions, in which case the government, under the Finch factors, is then able to relevantly bring back what she does remember saying to law enforcement, which in this case was that the appellant rubbed himself against, was that she said no and that she was crying and that she did not recall going up the stairs. The second part of that is that, as this Court also pointed out in Finch, even though the government is limited to the consistent statements, inconsistent statements might still be able to be introduced by the opposing party through the rule of completeness 106. So in terms of the fairness that my friend pointed out before, this is an adversarial proceeding, and on one hand, the United States doesn't have an obligation to present all of the previous consistent statements. But at the same time,
I don't hear that as a limiting principle. I hear you opening the door wider.
Well, respectfully, no, Your Honor, because of the first part of the Finch that I was mentioning before about it needing to be relevant. But insofar as...
So is that the only limiting principle the government can identify here, is the issue of whether it's relevant? There are no other limiting principles here?
Well, with regard to the plain language of MRE 801, as well as this Court's opinion in Finch, as well as our sister Court's opinions in the Second Circuit, et cetera, that is what the rule does allow in this case. And if the Court is inclined to believe that that opens a certain amount of floodgates, this is an adversarial system where then my opposing counsel would have been able to bring in the other parts of the statements that they felt proved their case. So...
Well, counsel, since you paused, I was going to hold up. But how does government address the appellant's argument with regards to the Finch factor four? Say that three times fast. Finch factor four, with regards to that the statement, the government should not be allowed to kind of create the error and then correct the error by virtue of bringing in a prior consistent statement.
Yes, Your Honor, and there's two responses to that. The first is that 801 doesn't expressly require that the attack come from the opposing party, but this Court need not deal with that because even though the United States on base said, were you able to give law enforcement and prosecutors every single detail every time, and the victim replied, not every time, sir, the trial defense counsel then went further and went ahead and confronted her about specific details which she did or did not remember, some of which she acknowledged that she didn't remember and some of which she acknowledged she didn't tell law enforcement. And that included such things as appellant went to the bathroom on page 266, that he hovered in her bed on 266, that it was a mutual decision to buy alcohol on 272, that appellant shushed her on 273, that appellant pulled a blanket over them beginning on 274, and that she was in bed wearing clothes on 275. Appellant is attacking the difference between what she said in testimony versus what she said in a detail and a manner that is much more in depth than what the United States did, which was present the evidence warts and all.
Lieutenant Commander Wuzu, let's assume for the moment, and only assume for the moment, that the Court decides this was an erroneous admission, that the judge erred. And I notice in both sides' briefs, each accuses the other side of having a weak case in determining prejudice, which leaves somebody like me to conclude, well, maybe they're both sides are weak. Both cases were. So if that's where Judge Sparks is, what is it in your argument, because the government would have the burden on prejudice, right? What is the strongest point to conclude that you've met your burden, assuming we get to that point, on the issue of prejudice?
Yes, Your Honor. And the government, of course, the burden you're referring to is beyond reasonable doubt. For with regard to the factor test, I think the crux of it is whether, minus that evidence, the government's case becomes less weak in a sense. And here, all we have is the deputy is testifying to those three things. So minus those three things, the government's case is still exactly the same. The government put on the victim who testified in detail, in much more detail, over about 40 pages of testimony compared to the rebuttal of about a page and a half. The victim yelled out frantically, naked, to her neighbor. She was distraught. The appellant, when undergoing undergoing voluntary interrogation, failed to assert that they had sex or that the victim consented, despite the fact that he was found naked in her bed in a state of intoxication. And in contrast, the appellant presented just one expert who testified that he believed that the victim was under the influence of drugs, but that was not based on any sort of first-hand examination of the victim. It was only based off of the testimony of who is herself not familiar with drugs, as she testified. He also testified a little bit to the ability of either side to have formed an alcohol-induced blackout, which is something that the members would have considered. However, this additional testimony that she said no does not stop the fact that the members did hear that she said no in the context of him pushing his face away and while she was being rubbed by him, all while she was crying and calling for her husband at the same time. The members still heard all of that. And insofar as she doesn't remember certain things, and maybe appellant doesn't remember certain things as well, the members know that she remembers from her testimony that he did this to her and that she did not consent and that she voiced her consent both through her no, through her crying, and through her calling out to her husband.
So I'd like to revisit the question posed by Judge Maggs. When he asked about whether it's permissible to clarify a central ambiguity, why shouldn't that give this court great pause? We've got the issue here is non-consent, which he testifies to is essentially, I don't have the exact wording in front of me, that when he kissed me, I said no. And then what comes in is, in fact, the quote-unquote prior consistent statement that puts a bow on that central ambiguity. Why shouldn't that cause this court to pause for a minute and say, is that really what is supposed to happen through this rule in terms of a prior consistent statement that really based on what was testified to, there's the ambiguity about what happened here?
Your Honor, 2 points. The first is based in the opinions from our sister courts as well. That's not what's required, this idea that if an idea is centrally important, that can't be with the subject of the rehabilitation.
No, of course not. But the question that Judge Maggs is posing is the government hadn't pulled the victim in this case across the finish line in terms of checking the boxes to get a conviction. What managed to do that really was the prior consistent statement. And the only limiting principle that you could identify is this issue of relevance. So why shouldn't this give this court pause about this is how something that goes to the very heart of an element of the offense comes in through the prior consistent statement and not through the actual testimony of the victim?
Yes, Your Honor. And so the first point was just legal-based. There isn't anything that would suggest otherwise. The limiting principles are inherent in that consistent statement, though, because she did testify that she said no. There was no additional ambiguity in this case that was added by him testifying that she said no. Perhaps there was more context to be had, but the removal of additional context didn't render the previous statement not generally consistent. And the appellant still could have cross-examined to elicit the additional details, if any, that the victim said with regard to her saying no. So while there are no limiting principles beyond what Finch itself points out, Finch itself does provide a certain check that this Court is asking for. So I'd like to talk about the temporal priority rule as the appellant talks about. That discusses what is now B1, and Tome, which the appellant relies on, is also about B1. The federal rules changed in 2014, and the military rules changed soon after to add B2. B2 was not found in common law, and even though there are certain aspects of the drafter's intent that were laid out, federal cases have shown that in a situation like this is a situation which falls under the plain meaning of those rules. Appellant's reliance on Kentucky cases to say otherwise is an error because Kentucky also didn't codify their rules of evidence until 1990, so Bussey was relying on those uncodified rules of common law evidence. So with regard to the prejudice analysis, I'd like to...
Look, counsel, in your brief, though, you agree that there is a requirement of I forget the exact phrase, but temporal relevance there, don't you? You're not disagreeing with appellant in this particular case, are you?
We disagree that it applies precisely for B2 cases such as this one, but it still exists with regard to B1 cases.
But I think appellant's position is not that it always applies in B2, but just as a logical matter that if you're arguing that somebody never recorded a memory, that just logically it couldn't rehabilitate if the malady preexisted before the statement. And so, in other words, it's not expressly put into B2 except through the word rehabilitate, which is just by logic it has to come first in some cases, such as if this is the ground that the memory was being challenged on. Now, I know you disagree with that point, but if the argument is because of her blackout, she could not record memories, then B2 would still require a statement, you know, a statement coming afterwards couldn't rehabilitate that.
Yes, Your Honor, and the fact that we disagree with the premise goes to the heart of my answer. It's not that trial defense counsel, for the purposes of this error here, said, you're saying for the first time on testimony X, you didn't remember, this is the first time you remember this, correct? What the trial defense counsel says here is, this is the first time that you're saying this now. You didn't say this to law enforcement before. And because trial defense counsel says, you didn't say this to law enforcement before, and she either agrees or doesn't remember, that is then why B2 is involved, which doesn't have the same strict temporal proximity rule, and why B1 is not involved, because it's not a general...
Well, I understand that B1 is not involved. I think the appellant's argument is simply that with B2, although it may not be required in all cases, it is if it's just logically incompatible for rehabilitation.
Yes, Your Honor. There may be certain circumstances in which such a rule would apply to B2. Such circumstances don't exist here, though, because what was attacked was her recollection of what she said to law enforcement, not her recollection writ large. So that's what was being attacked, and that's why it was the right person to rehabilitate her with the testimony about what she said to him that night two years before.
Now, on this point of disagreement about did she have faulty memory or inconsistent statements versus she couldn't record this, isn't that just left to the military judge, and isn't the government's position on this simply the military judge had to decide the ground upon which she was being impeached, and as long as it's not an abuse of discretion, the military judge did not as long as it's reasonable, the military judge didn't abuse discretion. Isn't that the government's position?
Yes, Your Honor.
So we don't really have to resolve this particular issue. We just have to decide whether the military judge abused the discretion in the way the military judge decided it.
Yes, Your Honor, in the sense that the government argued under B2, the judge found faulty memory. But insofar as Your Honor's previous question about whether temporal priority is involved in B2, then that would be a question for this Court.
But we'd only have to reach that issue if we disagreed with the military judges.
That's correct. I'd like to briefly turn to the prejudice analysis once more. The the defense counsel argues that the government really turned its testimony into a sword. I respectfully disagree. The government, in its closing argument, didn't mention, as appellate defense counsel acknowledges. It's only in rebuttal that the government says, and she told this as well. What the government instead argues is fair argument based off of the testimony of the victim. The defense counsel doesn't argue at that point in response to the government's argument that that's not the full quote. The defense counsel doesn't argue at that point that that's improper argument. The defense counsel doesn't argue before NMCCA that that's improper argument. But now is the first time that the defense counsel is arguing that that is the source of the prejudice for this. And not only is argument not evidence, but that small amount of evidence that was involved in was just one really small part of this case, and otherwise the case would have been exactly the same.
Any questions from the bench? Please briefly conclude.
Thank you, Your Honor. This court should affirm the lower court's opinion.
Tom Belter.
Thank you, Your Honor. Contrary to what the government just said, the government's case is not the same without this prior statement. Without that prior statement, the government has an ambiguity about what its case dispositive witness is saying no to. And an ambiguity like that in a criminal case is called reasonable doubt. Further, the government argued that the context in which all this was playing out, my colleague said the word context in regard to the touching of, but what the government is calling context, we're calling that the charged conduct, and that's not what said no to in her direct testimony. Further, the government just asserted that the attack was on what she said to law enforcement. But it's worth reiterating that the defense never challenged whether she said no. They never challenged that statement directly. And then second, the defense never challenged anything she said to. And so that rationale is unavailing as well. Further, the prior statement at issue here is not about what remembered. It's coming through testifying about what she told him. What she told him is not evidence of what she remembered or did not remember, because this is not coming from her. It's not her testimony now. It's testimony. And so, likewise, that's not rehabilitative either. It might be a different case if the government had decided to call her back to the stand to testify about what she did or did not remember. But that's not what happened here. And so what the case dispositive witness is saying no to, what conduct she's saying no to in a sexual assault trial, is the fact of the most central importance, which is what has to be consistent here pursuant to United States v. Finch. And it's not consistent. At best, it's an ambiguity. At worst, she's just not consenting to kissing and not necessarily to the charged conduct. And so because the rule does not allow the government to open its own door when it first introduced this issue, they should be precluded from allowing them to clear that up through this improper prior statement. And so for those reasons, this court should reverse the lower court and set aside the findings and sentence.
Any questions?
Yes, I have one question. The rule says consistent statement. Our precedent says generally consistent. Your position seems to be, well, it has to be really consistent if it goes to an element of the charged offense, which is otherwise not proved. How would you phrase the rule? I mean, if we had to say, well, the rule says consistent, but our previous cases say generally consistent, and the government says it's generally consistent, but we're disagreeing with the government, how would we phrase the rule for going forward? Does it have to be 100% consistent?
No, Your Honor. Appellant is not challenging what this Court said in United States v. Finch, that it has to be generally consistent. It's the words in Finch that come right after it, that it has to be generally consistent as to with facts of central importance. And so that means the way we interpreted that is first, the Court has to ascertain what are the facts of central importance. Here it's what conduct is she consenting to or not, and then is that statement, the prior statement, generally consistent with those facts of central importance? And here she's saying no to the charged conduct. That is not generally consistent with saying no to not charged conduct. And so this Court doesn't need to rewrite its rule in Finch in that regard. It's really just about how this Court and military courts going forward are going to apply that language.
Any further questions? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Case is now submitted. The Court thanks counsel for both sides, and the Court will stand adjourned until 9:30 tomorrow morning.
Court stands adjourned until 9:30 tomorrow morning.